Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking to former English teacher and now author and the queen of comparative judgment. It is, of course, Daisy Christodoulou, and you'll be not surprised at all to hear that this is a bit of a classic. A couple of things to tell you about before we get cracking. Firstly, sponsor slots for the Tips for Teachers podcast are now open. So if you want to let the world's most interesting listeners know about your book, product or event, just drop me an email. You can view videos of all of Daisy's tips, plus the tips of my other guests on the Tips for Teachers website. These are great to share in a departmental meeting or a training session. You can also sign up for the Tips for Teachers newsletter to receive a tip in your inbox most Monday mornings to try out with your classes in the coming week. And finally, just one little request for me, and if you could do it now, that'd be amazing. Just hit pause on the podcast and just give us a quick review, ideally a positive one, on your podcast player of choice. It really does make a difference. Thanks so much. Right, back to the show. Let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Daisy Christodoulou. Spoiler alert, here are Daisy's five tips. Tip one, review each lesson plan in terms of what the student is thinking about. Number two, ask a question at the end of every lesson that every student should be able to get right. Tip three, ready for this one? Don't do written comments. Tip four, use examples, not definitions, when teaching and assessing. And finally, tip five, get your pupils to spell their name backwards. Now, I think Daisy's lost the plot a little bit when she gets to tip five, but just stick with it. Let's just go with it. It'll be fine. All right, if you look at the episode description on your podcast player or visit the episode page on tipsforteachers.co.uk, you'll see I've timestamped each of the tips so you can jump straight to anyone you want to listen to first or re-listen. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Daisy Christodoulou to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Daisy. How are you?
Hi, Craig. I'm well, thanks.
That's fantastic. And for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Yeah, sure. I'm the Director of Education at No More Marking. We provide online comparative judgment schools for thousands of schools in lots of different countries.
Fantastic. All right, let's dive straight in. What's tip number one for us today?
So tip number one, I've shamelessly stolen. I've stolen it from Professor Dan Willingham. And it is, let me make sure I get it right. It is review every lesson plan in terms of what the students are thinking about. And Dan Willingham says that he's professor of cognitive science, I think, at the University of Virginia. And what he's trying to do is tell you what useful advice cognitive science can give teachers. So what do teachers need to know about how the mind works? And he said, this is actually one of the most useful pieces of advice, given everything we know about cognitive science. So it might sound really simple. It might sound really basic. I'll say it again. Review every lesson plan in terms of what the students are thinking about. You might think that's really obvious. That's just really, really silly. But first of all, I'll explain why it's important. And then I'll explain, this is something that I did with my own teaching. I'll explain kind of the difference it made. So why is this important? Why is it important to think about what the students are thinking about? Well, it's important because it's all to do with long-term memory. We know that long-term memory is really important. And we know that all of the higher order thinking skills that we're interested in developing in our students depend on the knowledge we have stored in long-term memory. And sometimes as adults, we can forget this. But just think of a simple example. You're just reading the newspaper in the morning, you know, you're online, you're flicking through reading a few articles on your phone. And just to make sense of a typical article in a typical newspaper, the amount of background knowledge you have to bring to bear, the amount of vocabulary you have to know just to make sense of that, there's a lot of knowledge going on there. And as adults, we do all that automatically. We take it for granted. So long-term memory is really important. We need stuff in long-term memory. So the really key question for teaching then becomes, how do we get stuff into long-term memory? How do we get students to actually remember things? And Willingham makes the point that the brain, what happens with the mind, we remember what we think about. We don't remember what we want to remember. It's not that we say to ourselves, I've really got to remember this, make sure I remember it, and that works. We all know that doesn't work. So the brain kind of makes a bet. If I have to think about something a lot, it's worthwhile hanging on to it, remembering it. And that's often why there's a lot of things in life that you never really wanted to remember that have stuck in your mind. Perhaps things that you just, you know, things that were pinned on the wall in front of you for like, I don't know, you know, in a classroom or on a long bus journey, you know, a particular advert, you know, those things kind of stick in the mind because you're thinking about them a lot. So that is therefore why Willingham says, review every lesson plan in terms of what the students are thinking about. because what they think about is what they'll remember. And remembering is really important. Like, remembering is learning in a lot of ways. So when I tried this out, I remember reading William for the first time thinking, great, I'm going to give this a go. And I went through some lesson plans and I was like, what will the students be thinking about at each point? Now, obviously, the tricky thing is you don't always know what the students will be thinking about. A lot of them are beginning daydreaming about dinner. But to the best extent, what is the aim of what am I trying to get them to think about? And what I realised with a lot of my lessons is that there were a lot of maybe quite complicated activities I was trying to set up that involved like a lot of admin and logistics and a lot of explanation. And so the students were thinking about all of those and trying to work those out and not necessarily about the content I was teaching. And so what it made me do is think, well, how can I simplify this and just strip it back a bit more and get to a point where we're just getting to thinking about, you know, the novel that I'm teaching or, you know, whichever grammatical concept rather than, you know, a complicated worksheet or a kind of jigsaw or some kind of activity or, you know, so keeping it really simple. And then following on from that, I think then it leads you to think that having a classroom where you do similar activities all the time is good because then it reduces the amount of time you have to spend explaining them. So if you particularly like think, pair, share, and that's something you think is really powerful, then don't just do it once or twice, actually make it a routine because then you haven't got to explain it as much. So that was the impact it had on my teaching. I mean, the other thing William says is the example he gives in his book is a teacher who took a class to the computer lab to research the Spanish Civil War. And he said within minutes, the assignment, it went from research the Spanish Civil War to creating PowerPoint slides with cool animations of Spain in the Spanish flag colours, right? And so that's the other issue, is that a lot of the time you set up a learning objective, research a Spanish Civil War, and what are the students thinking about? They're thinking about, yeah, esoteric features of PowerPoint. So I think there's a number of different ways in which that a piece of advice is really powerful. And it's one of those, it seems really simple, but I think give it a go and it's really, really interesting.
I love it, Daisy. One of my all-time favourites. Cool. I'm really pleased you brought this up. So two quick observations from me, then one follow-up question. Yeah. So the first is I love the idea of these kind of common activity structures like think, pair, share, something that you're going to use them several times so that you don't have to think about them much and the kids don't have to think about them as much so you can dive straight into thinking about the actual content and the learning. I think that's a really, really important one. And the second one, just to reflect on a couple of ways this has gone wrong in my teaching. So in my first book, I talk about Swiss rolls. I tried to teach fractions via the medium of Swiss rolls. It was an absolute disaster. And 4 years later, the kids remembered the Swiss rolls, but not a thing about the content of the lesson. And Dani Quinn has a great example of this as well, where she tried to teach surface area of a sphere using an orange. And you start peeling the orange, and if you peel it, you can lay it out in the exact number of circles that you need. But one, it never works. And two, the kids just remember all the orange peel and, you know, juice flying in their eyes and blinding them in left, right and centre. So there's loads of examples of this. And my follow-up question, though, Daisy, is this a good idea or a bad idea, putting it into lesson plans? Because you never see in lesson plans, it's all about, you know, what's the activity, maybe what's the teacher doing. Is it worth, if you have to do a lesson plan, banging in there what you hope the students will be thinking about? Is it worth making it that explicit, or do you think that's a step too far?
I kind of think it depends. I think when I trained to teach, you know, every lesson plan had to be 15 pages long. I think everyone's stepped back a bit on that now, quite rightly. So I actually wouldn't want to say anything that is going to like add to the bureaucracy and add to that, because I know how things can get out of hand with lesson plans. So I wouldn't want to say that. I would say, you know, you want it more like a checklist, you know, the way like, I don't know, I guess like pilots have checklists.
So I think that when you talk about the oranges there's a really interesting point with that. That I do think the principle I've just said, review every lesson plan in terms of what the students are thinking about. The slight tension that there is with that is another thing William talks about is we learn new things by connecting them to old things. And so this is why analogy is so important. And if you think about it, that's a little bit in tension with review every lesson plan in terms of what you're thinking about, because you want the students to be thinking about what you want to teach them. But on the other hand, teaching something new, you need to activate the prior learning and connect with something previous. And often with subjects like maths and science, you're often doing that kind of concrete to abstract and the fractions, you know, you think about Swiss rolls or pizzas. But then if you're spending all the time talking about pizzas, is that then interfering with actually we're doing fractions? And I've seen this happen with history too, and lots of lessons where you're trying really hard to come up with an analogy, and actually the analogy ends up distracting rather than helping. And I don't think there's an easy solution to that. I think you do need analogies, and I think analogies are really important. So I'm not saying never use them. I just think that a good analogy is hard. And a lot of analogies that we as adults think are really great are not actually that useful. They require more explanation than they do. They actually enlighten. So it's a tricky one.
It is a tricky one. Yeah. Okay, Daisy, what's tip number two, please?
So tip number two follows on from review every lesson plan. Tip number two is ask a question at the end of every lesson that every student should be able to get right. And this was something I started doing following on from reviewing every lesson plan, because you think, well, if I want the students to be thinking about this, and this is the thing I want them to be thinking about, in a sense, I'm trying to be really precise about what it is I want them to be thinking about. And if that's worked, if they really have been thinking about the thing I wanted, they should really all be able to answer a certain question by the end of the lesson that I've decided at the beginning, this is the question I want them to be able to answer. And when I first started doing that, I thought, yeah, this should be really easy. Actually, there should be 10 or 15 questions they should all be able to answer and get right. And then you do it, and then in a way, it's a sort of blow for kind of how, what you're teaching, the reality of your teaching as opposed to what you think it is that you can end up asking a really, really simple question that you think, surely you must have got this, and, you know, 3/4 of the class get it wrong. So I think if you decide up front, if there's just one thing that I want them all to walk away knowing that they didn't know at the start, what would that be? It really focuses your mind with the planning. And it focuses your mind and makes you think, okay, this one thing, this one question. And that might even be if you're introducing a new novel, if you're introducing a new text, or you're reading a chapter of a text, it might just be like the main plot point in that chapter. It might just be the main new character who's introduced. So it could be something. So it's the other point about this is people, it's one of these things, people think, oh, this is too trivial. But it's meant to be, it's not designed to be tricksy. It's meant to be easy. It's meant to be something that 100% of students can get right. And actually, I think you'll actually find you really struggle to find one thing, but it really focuses your teaching. It makes your teaching, I want them to know this one thing. Obviously, you don't want it to turn into, I spend a 60-minute lesson just, you know, regurgitating this one thing. But as I say, if you're doing it in the context of, say, a novel, where you're reading the next chapter, or, you're looking at a particular character, is there one thing at the end of this I want everyone to get right? What would that be? And just being really focused on that. And maybe, if you go further and further along, you can do 2 or 3 questions. But I think that's it's a really nice thing that really focuses your teaching and planning.
I love this, Daisy. Right. Again, same thing. 2 quick observations on this, and then a follow-up question for you. The first is, this reminds me when Dylan William was on the show a few weeks back saying about how making question planning central to lesson planning. And this feels like fits in really nicely with that. So when you're thinking about your lesson, almost starting in a sense with this final question that you want everyone to be able to answer, and how do you shape the lesson around how to get to that point? So that feels like that fits really nicely. Second observation, I've messed this up as well, Daisy, in the past, which is the last question I've asked kids in a lesson is always the hardest question. It's like it builds up to this.
Yeah.
And that's quite bad because but a load of the kids don't get it right, so they feel crap about themselves. And also, I haven't got a real good sense of how the majority of kids have understand the core element of the lesson, because I haven't assessed that at the end. I've assessed something different, almost like the challenge or the extension. So I like the idea of not ending on the hardest question, but ending on a question that kind of assesses the core knowledge, the thing that you really wanted all the kids to get. So I really like that. But my kind of follow-up question to you on this is, how does this fit in with exit tickets, Daisy? Would this be an exit ticket? And what's your view generally on exit tickets? How do you see this question being asked and playing out at the end of the lesson?
Yes, I think it can work in a number of different ways. I think it could be an exit ticket. It can be a mini whiteboard. I think I agree with what you said about too often you're kind of building up the lesson. It's getting more complicated. And then the thing you do at the end is like the challenge.
Yeah.
And actually, almost in some ways, it's better maybe to do a question at the end that recalls something a bit more basic from the beginning, and then it functions as a bit of retrieval practice.
Yeah,
it's almost like your first retrieval. And even if it was something simple that they got, you know, halfway through the lesson or a third of the way into the lesson, well, you know, if it's an hour-long lesson, 30 or 40 minutes might have passed since they did that, so it's worth just refreshing it at the end, even if it's really simple. So I think the challenge always at the end of the lesson is leaving enough time. I always found that I would like rush, you know, you run out of time towards the end and you know it's really important to get it in, and then you're rushing and like the bell's ringing. So I think it's really important to give it enough time at the end. And I think, you know, again, with exit ticket, mini whiteboard, like, you know, whatever kind of works for you, but I would go back to the first principle of, you know, not getting massively complicated structures around it, and trying to keep it as simple and repeatable and like almost as a routine as possible. So, you know, I think mini whiteboards in maths work really well. And I've seen them work really well. I think sometimes I think it is a, can be slightly trickier in English because you're maybe looking for maybe like a full sentence. Mm-hmm. You're looking for something, you know, it might not be right. They can, obviously can work, but I can understand that there might be reasons why you want something a little bit different. So I think, yeah, you know, find something that works for you, that's repeatable and that isn't, you know, the admin of it isn't taking up too much time. You can also do, if you want to do a multiple choice question, you can do that on a mini whiteboard. You can do that even simpler, just, you know, five options, raise your hand, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that doesn't require any kind of special equipment at all. But you then, if it's a multiple choice question, you've got to have really thought of it before. You can't just come up with that on the fly.
yeah. Just on that, just as a slight aside, I'm obviously obsessed with diagnostic multiple choice questions, but I think they work really well as this final question in a lesson because they're quick to get the kids' responses. And if you identify a problem, you've got a better insight as to why it's a problem based on the specific answers the kids have given. And if the vast majority of kids get it right, you can then turn your attention to the wrong answers to start thinking, well, why is this wrong? And so on. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. You get your assessment done quickly, and then you've got a kind of path to go if there's trouble, and then also a natural path to go if the understanding's there. So I'm completely biased, of course, but I like using diagnostic questions for exit tickets. I think they work quite well as that final question in a lesson, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I'd be, you know, think that works well as well. Definitely.
You're legally obliged to say that, Daisy. So that's good. All right, Daisy, what is tip number three, please?
So tip number three. So I'll be up front here. The first two tips are ones I've used myself when I was teaching. The third tip is one that I wish I'd had when I was teaching, but I didn't have. It's something that I've seen lots of people do since I left the classroom. And I think it's brilliant. And I wish it had been around when I was teaching. So my tip is don't do written comments. It's my third tip. Don't do written comments. And again, when I trained to teach, lengthy written comments were all the, you know, all the rage. The real kind of thing that everyone said was you want to give students feedback based on the language in the mark scheme. Mm. And the idea was that'll make it really transparent. You know, you've got this mark scheme. This is what the students have got to do. You're going to give them the feedback using that language. And I take, you know, I've spent hours doing this. So, you know, Sunday evenings, reading through sort of, you know, 25, 30 books, writing a comment at the bottom of them, taken from the mark scheme. And then you try and find little hacks to kind of shorten it. So you basically realise there's sort of three main issues going on. And you think, well, there's three main comments. So I'm going to basically going to write out the kids are all going to get one of these three comments. And I've seen people kind of hack it a bit further and sort of do this in Excel and have it a bit mal-mergy. But the problem with all of this is that written comments are a terrible way of giving feedback, right? And let me give you, I'll give you three examples. So one, this is from Dylan William. He talked to a student who's been given the feedback. You need to make your scientific investigations more systematic. So that's your classic take the feedback from the mark scheme. Yeah, the mark scheme will say, you know, top grade, systematic scientific investigation. So Dylan William says to the student, what does that mean to you? And the student says, I don't know. You know, if I knew how to be more systematic, I would have been more systematic the first time. Yeah. You know, and it's very flippant, but it's true. The one I was guilty of in that way was you need to infer more insightfully. You know, I can remember writing that out more times than I care to mention. Like, what is the student going to do with that? You know, and the problem with these. So again, Dylan William, he goes on to say, he says, it is true. This student did need more systematic. It was true. My students did need to infer more insightfully. I mean, don't we all, right? But is telling a student that going to help them improve? So this kind of feedback is true but useless.
Yeah.
So it may well be accurate, but it's not giving them anything they need to get better. And that is a problem with the nature of written comments. So then people feel, oh, I can give more precise comments. That is a problem with the nature of written comments. That it is really hard to express some of the information you need about how to improve, to express it in a kind of one sentence prose comment that's written down. So, you know, my one example, you need to make more scientific investigations more systematic. You need to infer more insightfully. I'll give you another example. Imagine you're in a driving lesson and you do a 3-point turn and you know, you're a bit shaky on it. You think it's okay. And you say to the instructor at the end, like, how did it go? And he goes, yeah, I'll give you a written comment like a week later. Like, that's mad, right? You get a written comment a week later. But what you need is just, you just need him to say then and there, him or her to say then and there, look, you know, you just did too much the first time. You know, probably say, let's have another go. You probably put a bit too much on the first time. You know, take a little bit off. You did really well as you were coming round. You checked everything. That was great. As you went in, you know, you need them to give you something in real time, and you need them to give them in real time that's better verbally, because those things I've just said verbally, you know, you put a bit too much on first time. That makes sense if someone's saying it in real time. That's incredibly useful. If you wrote that down, it's just like, what? I put a bit too much on first time. What is that? And it's the same with all kinds of feedback. That if you're going to give someone something written a week later, it's just not going to be helpful. If you give them something verbally in the moment, it can be incredibly useful. Obviously, I know where this is going. Problem is, some of that verbal feedback in the moment can't be captured. It can't be turned into a spreadsheet. And then I know that what, you know, managers will therefore say is, I don't know it's happening. You know, like a head teacher and a deputy will say, well, how do I know that's happening? People want something that is recordable. They want to be able to show that it's happening. And so I think we can view feedback almost on a spectrum, is that you have these in the moment verbal bits of feedback, which are incredibly powerful and valuable and very hard to capture and record. And then I think there's probably some things which are maybe still can have a bit of best of both worlds, and they're still able to be recorded and captured, but they still have high value. And that's why I'd say the multiple choice questions are quite good, is that I think there's something that is very recordable and very able to be put into a spreadsheet, but they're not as vague and as unhelpful as a written comment. So I think we've got to find a sweet spot. I'm not denying that it is important to capture and record things. It is. I'm not trying to say it isn't. But I think that when you get to written comments, it is like the triumph of wanting to put something into a spreadsheet over doing something that's useful. So, you know, you've traded off all the value for the wrong thing. So we have to try and get that trade-off right. So in terms of don't do written comments, I've seen so many schools now experimenting with whole class feedback. So for the English teacher like me, where you've got 30 books to mark or whatever, the idea would be, instead of putting a written comment at the bottom of each of them, you read them all and you make some notes about how you're going to replan your next lesson based on what you've seen in the writing. So what you would do is, if you've seen lots of issues with students, say their tense is very inconsistent, instead of writing out 25 times, you need to make your tense more consistent. At the start of the next lesson, you put up two sentences where the tense is inconsistent. And you say, can you change this second sentence into the first sentence? A bit like, again, the driving lesson. Let's do another three-point turn. Let's work on, you know, your overshooting. So that would be what you do. You come up with an activity, with an action step, with something you can do that focuses on what you've seen. And that is so, so, so much more powerful. So I really feel written comments, I think this is a really interesting one too, because there's something that we're all really familiar with as students ourselves. There's something that students, I think, actually kind of probably are quite attached to. They probably do see it as, my teacher cares about me. Yeah. So I think it is a hard one to move away from. It is quite counterintuitive. And I think, it, you know, people probably do just have this thing of, well, the teacher's just not working hard enough. They're not writing a comment. And that's what I'm saying. It's one of these classic things where it is your classic sort of busy work, that this is a very visible, highly visible form of work, but it's quite performative. But how much value does it add? And I'm just really, the more and more I think about it, the more I think, I don't think it adds much value. I think in some ways it takes away value. And the amount of time it takes is astonishing. Really is astonishing.
I agree with 100% everything you've said, Daisy, but you've got to help me out on something here, right? So the first thing is, just to reflect on that, I think you're right. The reason that these stay in schools, well, why schools insist on written comments is, as you say, so there's evidence both from, you know, a management perspective or whatever, and also from students recognising that the teachers looked at their books, and probably parents wanting to see it in the books and so on and so forth. And I also completely agree that whole class feedback is a million times more effective. But here's the problem I always run into. So your ideal scenario when you're marking a set of 30 books is either everybody's nailed everything and then you can just move on, or everybody's got the same problem so you can do whole class feedback. I always find it's a bit trickier whenever you've got, well, a couple of scenarios. One where there's a scattering of different issues amongst the work. So there's like seven or eight problems that, that you've identified. And also where you've got a significant group of children who really have nailed the kind of a concept and a significant group of children who really haven't. And then what do you do in that follow-up lesson? So if you can solve those problems for me, Daisy, I'm laughing here.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. It is tricky. It is tricky. And I think the thing to say is those things are genuinely tricky issues. Yeah. They don't invalidate. None of them mean that written comments work. we still have to move away from the written comment, but you're absolutely right. They do mean that, well, what do we do? They still are, you know, issues for what you replace it with and how you optimize that solution. I think that one thing I'd say is, in some ways, and I'm coming from a bit of an English teacher perspective here, but you almost don't want to move to the complex written task too soon. And you want to make sure that by the time you move to it, you're not going to be seeing a really wide variety of errors. You almost want to get to the point that you've done enough teaching beforehand such that they're not all going to be perfect in this piece of writing, but you're not going to see a huge variety in terms of quality. So that, you know, yes, there will still be some pupils have absolutely nailed it, some have got errors, but, you know, hopefully there's going to be a bit more of a clustering. That'll make it easier to feedback. And I think some of the reasons why this can be tricky is you do get this huge range of responses and it's very, very difficult to tease it out. And that's because maybe the teaching beforehand, there just hadn't been much of it. The students have moved to the written task too soon. And that's, again, where I'd say with the multiple choice questions, the short answer questions, like do more of them to begin with in a unit. So start with all those questions where it's easier to do the diagnosis and don't put them onto the open task, which will always be trickier to assess until they've got to a solid point. So that'd be my first thing, like try and set it up so you're anticipating that and trying to forestall that problem. Obviously you will still have a range of responses and I think it depends slightly. I would still say, you know, with some, again, something like English, I remember from my experience, I was just reading, we've just done a big literature assessment on an unseen poem. You do still see, you know, it does tend to be, often there will be one or two issues that are cropping up that are the same. So I feel like even when you've got a range of responses, there's always one or two things you can pick on, you know. Then in terms of how you follow up with other students, I think the other thing I said, it doesn't have to necessarily be straight away in that lesson. If there are bigger issues, maybe it's something where you're adapting your scheme of work. Okay, so if there's a bigger issue that they're struggling with, I mean, an example I give with an inspector calls is students confusing Eric and Gerald. And if you see that coming up in a lesson, in a response, that's something you can address straight away in the following lesson, but it's something you can keep addressing in future lessons. You know, you've got that on your radars, that's been an issue. So there's some things, you know, you can address straight away, there's some things you can keep going over. I then think if you're in a situation where you're lucky enough where you've got a teaching assistant, I know in primary often that's more often the case, it's something a teaching assistant can really help with. That if you've got a small group of students where, you know, maybe it is the Eric and Gerald example and three of them have made that error and the others in your class are absolutely fine, that's a great thing where the teaching assistant can take them away and walk them through, okay, this is Eric, this is Gerald, let's not confuse those again. And that will be the kind of thing a teaching assistant, I think, could do really well. So I think you absolutely put your finger on a really important issue with that. I think it's you have got to think about it. What I would say is that even with that issue, it's still better than written comments. Definitely don't do written comments.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the final thing I'll just say on this, Daisy, is I always found that when my check for understanding in lessons was poor, I ran into more of these problems with the homeworks because homework was full of surprises for
exactly,
me.
Exactly.
The better I got at checking for understanding, the less of a surprise there was in the homework. So the more it lent itself to whole class feedback, if that makes sense. It's all intertwined, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Daisy, tip number four, please.
Yeah. So this also follows on a bit from the one before. So I said that written comments are not great. And my fourth tip is to use examples, not definitions, when you are teaching and assessing. And this follows on a bit from written comments, because in lots of ways, definitions have a lot in common with written comments. So we think of definitions as being maybe something very powerful, something that we want students to memorize. But often the problem with a definition is it only kind of sometimes makes sense when you know what it is to begin with. And so I often say to people, have you ever had an experience when you were a kid where there's a word you didn't know and you look it up in the dictionary and you don't know any of the words in the definition in the dictionary? And then what do? Do you go and look up every word in the dictionary definition? And so it's a bit chicken and egg here. So the paradox, this is why reference sources are great for adults, are great for experts, and not so great for novices. any reference source, not just a dictionary, but Google, you know, online searches, is that when you have that basis of knowledge to be able to create a search and interpret what you see, reference sources are amazing. If you don't, reference sources are not the place to gain that knowledge. What is the way? So then the question is, well, okay, well, how do we gain that knowledge? And that's why I say examples. Examples are really how we learn. And there's really interesting stuff on the philosophy of science about this. So Michael Polanyi and Thomas Kuhn, they both write about this in terms of scientific breakthroughs and how scientists come up with kind of new ideas, or in terms of words in science, like the word energy in physics. What does that mean? And you can come up, you can't really come up with a definition for it. And they'll also say, Thomas Kuhn writes about how a student can read a chapter of a physics textbook, say they've understood it, and they can get to the problems at the end of the chapter and not get them right. And he says it's the problem set at the end of the chapter that really communicates the concepts. And I think that's true of all learning. We learn with examples, not with definitions. And as I say, a lot has been written about this, that the kind of very high end of science, of sort of physics and maths, and how you have these big, you know, scientific revolutions. But you can see it in everything, and you can see it in the basics of how younger children learn. And the area where I've engaged with it most is in teaching, is in grammar, and particularly one I'm fascinated with is verbs. Because I just fit a verb, it's a bit like energy in physics. Like I've just come to the conclusion there's no really good way of defining a verb that is going to let anyone, child or adult, reliably then use that definition to decide what, you know, get 100% right, you know, finding the verb in 200 sentences. It just, and then people sort of wrestle over definitions. So obviously the one that a lot of kids will come up with, they'll know, is a verb's a doing word. And then you have people who go, oh, that's just too trivial, and they'll come up with this more complicated definition, a verb is a state of action, blah, 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 state of being. And they'll say that's a much better definition. And my point is, we can argue about the definition all day long. Like, you know, I don't think either of them are good definitions, because I just don't think it's possible to define it to do what you want it to do. And what is the way you're really going to learn what a verb is lots of examples. And then my favourite sort of, you know, the two examples which will show where students are up to with their understanding of a verb, is give them a sentence, I run to the shops, say what's the verb. Most students get that right. So most students will say run is the verb. And they'll do that because they probably do know verbs are doing word, something to do with running, but run. So then you give them the sentence, I went for a run. Say what's the verb. And they'll all say run again. Okay, and then you say no, it's went. And they'll go, it can't be went, went's not a doing word. Right? But even if you taught them it's a state of action or being, went doesn't sound like a verb. It just kind of doesn't. And yet it's, you know, one of the top 5, 10 most common verbs, or, you know, comes from go, which is the same with be. The hardest verb of all to understand is the most common verb. So to be is the most common word in verb in English, and it's the hardest verb to understand in terms of if you're going to define it as a doing word. Like, just doesn't sound like that. So how do you get around this? It's just not with definitions, with lots and lots and lots of examples, and seeing examples in lots and lots and lots of different contexts. And I think that's true for all learning, that we need to have those concrete examples. And it's through encountering lots of those that we can then start to build them up into something a bit more of an abstract understanding, and start to see why people have come up with the idea that verbs are doing word, that it probably is, given everything we've got, the best way we can define it in the abstract. But you have to build up that understanding with the examples. And as I say, the reason why I think this is similar to the written comment issue is written comments are these sort of abstracted statements that mean something to an expert. So when you say, oh, I need to infer more insightfully, I know the kind of typical piece of GCSE writing that doesn't infer insightfully, and it's staying on the surface level and it's not digging down any deeper. So, you know, it does have some kind of meaning, but it's not helping a student to infer more insightfully. And so it's the same issue with the written comments. It's the same issue with relying on mark schemes to give you agreement. It's the same issue with relying on definitions. And it's one of the reasons I do have a slight worry about knowledge organisers. And I think knowledge organisers, they can be designed very well, but they can be a bit too reliant on definitions. Mm. And I just think you have to be really careful with that. You have to be really careful that the knowledge organiser isn't too reliant on definitions, and it is making sure that it's you know, that it's giving examples. Really, so, you know, when you've got a knowledge organiser, you're saying, you know, what is a verb? And if what you see on the other side is It's a doing word. I'm a bit uneasy about that. I'd rather see, what's the verb in this sentence.
Yes. Well, this is, when I saw this on your list of tips to discuss, I was well happy, Daisy, because it's one of my favourite things to talk about. So let me try and sell you on the dream of this. What's something that works in maths? Because I've been looking for someone to talk to about this who's not a mathematician to see if this works elsewhere. So you're just the person for this, Daisy, right? So maths is rampant for definitions. And exactly as you say, they are terrible. Like the definitions are far more complicated than the actual thing itself. So when I first started teaching, I was definition crazy, then realized that was a waste of time. Then I switched to kind of a single example, and that's a bit problematic. So if we use triangle's a good one here. The definition for a triangle is terrible because you've got to understand what a plane figure is, what a side is, what an angle is. So then you give the kids an example of a triangle, but the problem with that is you tend to stick to a really conventional one with a horizontal base and isosceles and so on. So that's not great. So then I learned to do more varied examples. So you have some scalene triangles and so on. That's good as well. But then to truly understand what something is, you've got to know what it isn't. So then you switch to non-examples. So this is a triangle. This is not a triangle. That's definitely better. But where I'm at the moment is I like related examples and non-examples. And I think this fits in well with your run thing there. So you start off with something that is a triangle and you change one feature of it. So maybe the orientation and everything else stays the same. The lengths of the side, the angles stay the same, but just one critical feature's changed. And then you say, is this still a triangle? Oh yeah, it is. Okay, so the orientation doesn't matter. Now let me change one thing. So let me break one of the sides. So all of a sudden it doesn't completely close. But everything else is the same. The orientation, the size are the same. All right, now that's not a triangle. So that critical feature has broken the kind of, it's crossed the example, non-example boundary. So I think that examples and non-examples are one of the most powerful things you can do, but I think you can almost supercharge them if you make them related to each other so kids can observe the single critical feature that's changed and the impact it's had. Now, does that make sense, and does it transfer across? Would that be something you would do with verbs and things like that?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. So I think what you're trying to do is set up, it's all about the choice of examples, I agree.
Yeah.
And it's all about, can you set up example sequences essentially where the examples are exemplifying different features, and that you're carefully choosing them so they're exemplifying the different features that are critical to the concept in this case. So in your case with the triangle, you said, all right, the orientation is actually not a critical feature, so that's like a non-example, but the sides is a critical feature, so we're going to set up something like that. And I would say it's exactly the same with verbs, in that you would say, well, the position of a word in a sentence is not a critical feature. So what happens is the risk you can get, the equivalent of just teaching a basic triangle as an example, and then that's what they think is the only triangle, is always setting up sentences where the verb is the second word in the sentence. So I run to the shops, I go home, I walk around the park, he says hello, kind of thing. And then the students just get the wrong idea that, well, it's always, a verb's always a second word in the sentence. Yeah. So they've defined it too tightly. In the way, if you're just giving them a simple triangle, they're defining it too tightly as that's the, and it's with the orientation, the base at the bottom, that they're just saying that's the only triangle possible. So that's the equivalent you would get with a verb. And that's where I think a lot of students' understanding kind of is. So what you will then want to do is you have to come up with examples of where verbs are not the first word, the second word in the sentence, where they're, right in the middle of the sentence, third or fourth, that kind of thing. I think then the challenge is, when you're first introducing something, the best way of almost drip feeding with a complex thing like a verb or a triangle, there's lots of different features and lots of examples and non-examples. And how many of those do you want to introduce in one go?
Yeah.
One of the things that Siegfried Engelmann talks about when doing this with verbs, which I can never kind of make my mind up on this, is he says straight away you should be introducing verbs that are more than one word, not just one word. And I sometimes think that's kind of too hard to begin with. Like, is that like going in with an isosceles triangle? But I kind of think you do want to start. My take is you do want to sort of start with some of the obvious ones, but you don't want to spend so much time that they just think that obvious one is the only example. And I do think ultimately these are empirical questions which you can settle with research. And you can set up different sequences and say, well, which one leads to the best understanding. And this is why, Engelmann talks a lot about the picky detail. And this is what I think is picky detail, but it's really important. If you teach students a triangle and you introduce an isosceles triangle first or whatever, what impact does that have? You know, how should you be doing this? If you teach them, so, and I think the other thing is you can't view, the other thing I was going to say up front as well is the problem with all of these complex concepts is you're never going to teach them in a lesson. Just that they are hard, they are difficult. So you're not going to get a student to a perfect understanding of a verb or a triangle in a 60-minute lesson. However great you are and however amazing your students are, I just don't think it's possible. And I think that's why the other thing I think about a lot is, again, this is a bit of an Engel indirect instruction thing, is if you set up a perfect learning sequence, could you do it so that students never developed a misconception? And then you'd never have to be in a situation where you'd have to unpick a misconception because you'd have sequenced everything so perfectly yes. that there's no chance for a misconception to come in. And like that's kind of utopian. And I kind of like the idea, but I just think no for two reasons. One reason, a lot of the really complex concepts we want to teach students, they kind of exist a bit in the world anyway. So triangles, they're going to encounter a triangle before they meet you. Verbs, they're going to, using verbs every yeah. day. Yeah. So, you know, they're not coming in from like a, you know, zero knowledge. So there's going to be a chance that they've got some misconceptions even before they've met you. And the second reason is that even if it was by chance a concept they've never encountered before, so you're starting from baseline, because you cannot teach everything in one go, there's always the chance that some misconception will develop when you've only taught part of what the concept is.
Yeah.
And because it's impossible to teach the whole concept in one go, you're going to have to choose to start with some kind of triangle. You're going to have to choose to start with a verb being somewhere. I just think there's always going to be, I definitely think you want to minimize misconceptions, but I just think there's all, it's like there's always going to be a chance for them to come up. So you do have to kind of anticipate and expect and come up with ways of unpicking them when they do arise. So yeah. Bit of a tangent there, but yeah.
Really? No, I love that. Cool. Absolutely fascinating that, Daisy. I love that. Just final question on this before I hand over to you for your fifth tip. Just circling back to definitions, where do definitions come in then? Is it important that kids know the kind of formal definition or is just a knowledge of the concept without being able to articulate it enough?
Yeah, so I mean, so then this is it. So definitions, I think, the reason why they do exist and the reason why we do have dictionaries, the reason why I'm important is when you do get to a certain point, they give you a useful shorthand. So the way I talk about this, I talk about this a lot in context of the old national curriculum levels. And people would say the great thing about the national curriculum levels is they give you a shared language. And I would say they don't give you a shared language. They give you something that's far more dangerous. They give you the illusion of a shared language. It's like we're all using the word cat. And some of us are using cat to refer to a four-legged mammal. And the other rest of us are using cat to refer to a chair. Okay, so it is not a shared language. But obviously, shared languages do exist. Me and you are having a conversation now. We're able to communicate. Like, you know, so there, when, most of us, when we use the word cat, actually, we've got a similar concept in mind of what a cat is. So, you know, communication is possible. I'm not going down some extreme kind of postmodernist route here where it isn't. I'm just saying that the national curriculum levels were not a good shared language. So the point is that what you want to do is build up, if students, you can build up their understanding enough, you can get to the point where cat or triangle or verb becomes a very convenient shorthand for a concept that everybody agrees on. So that you do want to get to that point. And Doug Lamov makes this point very well about the value of a definition, which is that he talks about democracy. That's a really abstract term. And if you are not, if you're just talking about in a very concrete term, all the time you've got to go, oh, you know that thing where like we get out a big bag and we all have a stone and we all put the stone in the bag if we agree or we take it out if we don't agree. That's really convoluted. So if you can have an abstract word that embodies that very convoluted concrete process, that's really useful. And that speeds up communication and it speeds up thinking and it speeds up the ability to communicate with others and build on thought. So I do think definitions are important and I do think words are important. I just think words can be really dangerous in that you can use them, as I say, with CAT or with the national curriculum levels and think everybody is agreeing with you and actually you're all in your own bubble. So for me, it's about almost the aim of education is getting to a point where all these words do mean roughly the same things. And that is what enables, that's what enables communication. And more than that, that's what, to be honest, that's what enables civilization. Because if you can't talk to each other, you cannot build anything together. You know, whether that something is building a community or a society, or whether that something is building a complex, you know, complex artifact.
Flipping out, we're going deep, Daisy. I love it.
Definitely, all the time, Craig. Absolutely.
I said it would be the last thing, yeah. But just the final thing on that. That's why I'm quite a big fan of those, you know, the Freya diagrams or the Freya models, where at the end of a concept, the kids write a formal definition, mm-hmm. but then they have to give an example and a non-example of it. And I always like to just go one step further and say, give me an interesting example and an interesting non-example. Or in other words, give me an example that someone might think's a non-example and give me a non-example that someone might think's an example. Because I think if you can push kids right to the boundary of that definition, that's a really good test of whether they understand something or not. So I quite like doing that. But anyway, that's just
a... Sounds pretty good, yeah.
All right, Daisy, fifth and final tip.
Okay, well, we've done four serious ones, so I thought the fifth one, I'm going to do a jokey one. All right, so this fifth one is a jokey one. I was just thinking about this the other day. I used to teach the book Holes by Louis Sachar, which is, certainly when I was teaching, it was a bit of a staple sort of Key Stage 2, Key Stage 3 book. It's made into a very good film with Shia LaBeouf, which I can recommend. And the main character in Holes, his name is Stanley Yelnats. And a few chapters in, the author kind of reveals that Stanley and Yelnats, it's the same forward and backwards. So if you put Stanley backwards, it's Yelnats.
Yes.
And if you Yelnats backwards, it's Stanley. And when the kids learn that, you know, they just love it. They go, oh, and then you see them all starting to scribble it out. Stanley, Yelnats. And then they want to do it with their own name. So my jokey fifth tip, if you're an English teacher, is get the kids to, you know, do their name back and forward. It's quite fun. So mine is Isiad, and yours is Giark. You would be Craig. You would be Craig Giark, or you could be Notrab Barton. I'm Isiad. I'll be Daisy Isiad. I'm not going to do it my surname because it's just impossible. So, you know, that's just a little bit of fun if you're at teaching Holes.
I like
top
it.
Top tip.
Love it. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, Daisy, they've been five absolutely brilliant tips. So let me just hand over to you now. And what should listeners check out of yours?
So do have a look at nomoremarking.com. So I work full-time for nomoremarking.com. We provide these online comparative judgment assessments. And we've got two really nice newish developments that are around. So one is we've got a website called The Writing Hub, which is where we store kind of all of our exemplars, writing exemplars from students, lessons. So all the things I've said about teaching verbs, we have lots of lesson resources on teaching verbs. We have lots of professional development on writing. So do have a look, you know, have a look at what we've got there. And the newest thing we're about to work on, we're working on a platform that will automatically mark paper multiple choice questions for you. And it's called AutoMark. We've been trialing it with some schools, and we've been trialing it with writing quizzes. So lots of the things I've been saying about verbs and identifying the verb, we've got lots of quizzes set up that do that. We've been trialing it for a year, 18 months or so, and it's about to launch with more schools. So nomoremarking.com, Writing Hub, AutoMark, those are the three things we're working on. You know, take a look at our website and blog and find out more about them.
Fantastic. And just on that as well, and we've spoken over the years on my podcast several times about comparative judgment, and I was lucky enough last year, I think it was, to interview Ian from Loughborough, who talked about how to use comparative judgment in maths, and I'll put a link to that as well, because it's one of those things, there's a danger, isn't it? You can think comparative judgment is just for expansive writing and so on, but the way Ian describes assessing like problem-solving skills in mathematics using it it absolutely blew my mind. So I'll put
Ian has done some amazing work on that. It's really, really good. So yeah, definitely have a look at that.
Fantastic. Well, Daisy, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. I always learn loads and I always really enjoy it. Great. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today.
Really good. Really enjoyed that, Craig. Thanks.